Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special podcast from the Oldie. We open with the March of the Royal British Legion. In the lead up to Armistice Day on the 11th of November, as the rousing notes of the band of the Irish Guards fade, so we are reminded that this year, 2021, marks the 100th anniversary of the founding of an organisation which was conceived in the horrors of the First World War, whose purpose is the welfare of those who so selflessly have given and give of themselves in the defence of our nation and its way of life. The brave men, women and veterans of our armed forces. The Royal British Legion is no ordinary charity. It is a national institution with offshoots including Poppy Scotland and the National Memorial Arboretum. Sister organisations in Canada, Australia and New Zealand, and a reach into the farthest corners of the Commonwealth. It is unique. No other charitable institution is charged by a royal charter, and I quote, to maintain in a strong, positive, non-sectarian, united and democratic comradeship all those who serve or have served in our Navy, Army or Air Force, so that neither their efforts nor their interests shall be forgotten, that just and equitable treatment shall be secured to them in respect to the difficulties caused in their lives as a result of their services, and to perpetuate in the civil life of the Commonwealth and the world the principles for which the nation stands: loyalty to the Crown, community and nation, to promote unity amongst all classes, to secure peace and goodwill, and to safeguard and transmit to posterity the principles of justice, freedom and democracy. Back home, RBL provides a social and welfare network of 2,500 branches with local club rooms in towns and villages across the United Kingdom. And there are a further 80 branches worldwide, from Hong Kong to Gibraltar and Paris to Cologne. It has 50 marching bands and even its own bikers, the legendary Royal British Legion Riders. It is nothing short of comprehensive and remarkable. From care of the wounded to homes for the elderly and commemorative events with veterans transported by cruise ships and London taxicabs from the D-Day shores of Normandy to liberated Holland. It provides financial grants for those in need, employment assistance, support to the bereaved and even lobbies politicians on issues such as terms of service for Commonwealth nationals or ensuring that government and business respect the important role of the services in society by honouring the Armed Forces Covenant. But it is remembrance of those who so routinely make the ultimate sacrifice for the peace we enjoy today which sits at the very heart of the Royal British Legion. And a simple flower, the poppy, which grew in abundance on the killing fields of Flanders when the guns finally fell silent, has become the enduring symbol of our memory for the fallen, who must never be forgotten. For this special programme to mark the Royal British Legion, RBL at 100, it is my great privilege to be joined by Julie Summers, author of We Are the Legion, her beautiful book especially commissioned to commemorate RBL's centenary, 97-year-old Rear Admiral John Robert CB, who was born in Royal Pindy, joined the Royal Navy in 1938, aged 13, served aboard HMS Serapis at D-Day, was captain of HMS Ark Royal, and retired as Flag Officer Naval Air Command in 1978. And Michael Lewis, 38, who joined 2nd Battalion of the Parish Regiment in 2000, was injured in Afghanistan when his platoon was engaged by the Taliban and medically discharged in 2012 following a below-the-knee amputation of his right leg. And my good friend from Canada, Robert Lee, who for the last 7 years has been executive producer of the Festival of Remembrance every November.
Julie, of course, the title Royal came later. Why was the British Legion formed? And how did the story of the poppy begin with the Royal Charter, the huge unemployment and Field Marshal Haig?
Well, it all began before the Royal British Legion started up, which seems a bit of a tautology. But at the end of the, or towards the end of the First World War, there was real concern amongst the people who were looking after soldiers returning about the conditions that they were returning in. Some were very concerned with men who were disabled by their war service. Other people were worried about the plight of the orphans and widows. And so As a result, a few small organisations grew up, but they didn't have real clout because in some ways they were contradicting one another. So Earl Haig refused to be associated with any one of these four organisations that existed to look after soldiers and veterans of the First World War until they agreed to come together. And there was a great unity conference over the autumn of 1920 and into the spring of 1921, when members and representatives of these four organisations came together and they agreed to form a body. And there were 54 names proposed, but the British Legion won through. And on the 15th of May, 1921, members of representatives of each of the partner organisations laid a wreath at the cenotaph and agreed to join together. And their whole purpose was to look after the interests of the men who were returning from the First World War and for their families and dependents. And this represented a community of some 20 million people. So a huge number of people were affected by the Legion's work. And they had three basic tenets. The first, as you've mentioned, was remembrance, to remember those who had given their lives. But the second and very important one was to hold the government to account and to make sure that it kept its promise to offer war pensions and disability pensions to those who needed them. And the third tenet, which is central still to the Legion's work, was welfare. Because many men came back with serious wounds and serious disabilities, which would mean they found it very difficult to find work. So the Legion championed the rights of disabled men to seek work. And this amazing organisation, which was basically formed by very young men, I mean, the chairman and the first treasurer were in their 30s, and many of the veteran community were in their 20s. So it had a huge energy, this organisation. And so it came together in 1921, and over the period of the 1920s and into the 1930s, it campaigned vigorously for better war pensions for those who had fought, for widows' pensions, for health for the men who were suffering, for example, from tuberculosis. 50,000 men returned after the First World War suffering from this wretched disease. And by 1922, 18,000 of them had died. So the Legion knew there was a problem. Being a very creative, energetic organisation, it set up a hospital in Kent at a place called Preston Hall and grew the hospital from 190 odd beds to nearly 500 beds. And many, many men's lives were saved as a result of the Legion's hospital and the village that grew up around it. You asked about royal status. That was granted on their 50th anniversary in 1971, and to great excitement, I have to say.
And of course, central to the whole organisation is the poppy. How did the poppy come about as this wonderful symbol of RBL today?
It's a really rather wonderful story, but it came about because a woman called Madame Anna Guérin, the clue is in the name, she was French, had come to the conclusion that the poppy was the most valuable possible symbol of remembrance. She had read the In Flanders Fields poem by John McCrae, Colonel John McCrae, who very sadly died in January 1918. And she and another American woman called Moina Michael both independently came up with the idea that the poppy could represent the remembrance of those who died and could be a symbol for hope for the future. And Mrs. Guérin, Madame Guérin, travelled all over the United States with this message. She then went to Canada, and in September 1921, she arrived at the headquarters in Eccleston Square in Pimlico and sought a meeting with the British Legion, as it was then, and said, "I think my poppy could work as a symbol." And the initial reaction was a bit hesitant. Why? Who was this woman? What was her credentials that she would be, you know, proposing this? But they sent a man called Sir Herbert Brown out to Paris to check out Madame Guérin. And they found that not only was she legitimate, she had a lot of respect in France, but she was able to make 1 million poppies for the first Poppy Day appeal. And so the Legion took her up on the offer of making 1 million poppies. And in addition, they commissioned another 8 million poppies. And so for the first Poppy Day in November 1921, 9 million poppies, of which 1 million had been made in France, were sold to the public. And the public was absolutely enchanted. It got on immediately. It raised a very large sum of money, £106,000. £106,000, that's right, which is about 5.4 million in today's money. And Earl Haig realised that he not only had an appeal which could work and help to raise money for the Legion, but he had the perfect symbol. And it's a familiar symbol and it's still in use today.
Rear Admiral John Roberts, you have been associated with the armed forces for the better part of over 80, 90 years. Sir, what are your memories of war, specifically of wearing the poppy?
Well, I think I can go back a little bit. My first awareness of the Legion was probably when I was about 10 years old. And I had a grandfather who'd been commanding a battalion in France on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And he'd written to his wife, my grandmother, and said, at 7:30 on the 1st of July, I had 850 of as fine a body of men as I've ever served with. By 8:30, I had only 30 left. And those numbers are so horrific, really. And obviously 500 or 600 of the 800 who were casualties were going to be needing help from something like the British Legion when they came back home. And also, it's not only they need help, but the people who look after them need help. But you asked about my own experience of them. I commanded 3 ships during my time, and it was very comforting to know that if a sailor received a letter from home, either from his wife or somebody else, that there was a problem at home, the British Legion were people one could contact, and they would investigate and send a message back to me in my ship, and I could take what action was needed to either comfort the man or give him sick leave or something if he had to go home. So I personally had that contact with the Legion. And if I come back all 90 years that you mentioned, it's literally only a month ago that a very great friend of mine who lives in Kent here, he was a fighter pilot. He flew the Corsair aircraft in World War II. And he attacked the Tirpitz on 2 occasions and received the DSC medal. And then he was shot down off Japan. And he is now 99. And I heard literally 2 or 3 weeks ago that he has had to be moved into May's house in Brexhill. So that is the very latest knowledge that I have of what the Legion does.
Hello, I'm Warrant Officer 1 Steedman, Warrant Officer 2 the Royal Navy. Everybody within the Royal Navy would like to wish the Royal British Legion a happy 100th birthday. I've witnessed and seen firsthand the amazing work everybody connected with the Royal British Legion has done for our serving personnel, their families and our amazing veterans. And as better never stops, I would just wish you all the very best for the next 100 years. Thank you.
Michael, if I may, you of course have personal experience of RBL working on your behalf. Can you explain how you came to be involved with them and what they did for you?
So, thanks for having me. So I served with the 2nd Battalion Parachute Regiment from 2000 to 2012. And it was my tour of Afghanistan in 2008 where I sustained life-changing injuries. So I was involved in a huge firefight with the Taliban in August 2008. Protecting a convoy, and in the heat of the battle, unfortunately, I was hit by British friendly fire as a result of artillery round came in, dropped short, injuring me and 2 of my colleagues, which resulted in injuring my left arm and having my right leg amputated below the knee. The treatment I sustained and the way I was looked after was straight away when I arrived back in the UK, the Royal British Legion was there to give me everything I needed, from everything from a toothbrush right up to getting my family by my bedside. And that care kept on going my whole time in Birmingham St Oak Hospital. I spent over a year there, and they were there for all my admin needs and any problems, any situations I had. They helped with all my paperwork regards to my armed forces compensation, and then helped me when I was actually told I was going to be militarily discharged, helped with my transition from military to civilian street as well.
There's a land of peaking again on the other side on a hill, where we learn to love and live again when the world's quiet and still. There's a land of peaking again, and there's not a cloud in the sky where we'll never have to grieve again, and we'll never.
The Land of Begin Again, written by Huey Charles and Ross Parker, performed by Jamie Cullum at the 2009 Festival of Remembrance at the Royal Albert Hall. You're listening to a special programme of the Oldie Podcast with me, Harry Bucknell, to celebrate the Royal British Legion at 100.
Robert, you have been the executive producer for the Festival of Remembrance for the last 7 years. And can you tell us about the what I call the sort of the putty between the cracks that the Royal British Legion provides for the service community, that all important extra that Mike told us about, the add-ons that make the services community so very important?
Well, I think, Harry, since the beginning, the Legion first tries to get governments and responsible authorities to do their bit. But in the event that cracks are left or governments are slow to do their bit, the Legion will again step in to make sure that needs are not left unmet. And it's been central to the Legion that before we ask our generous donors and our own members to provide something like a tuberculosis sanatorium in the aftermath of the First World War, we asked the government to do that. The government in that case refused, but donated an unused hospital to us for the purpose. Similarly, today, most of our campaigns, which are enormously successful, I believe we have over a period of 100 years a 95% success rate with our campaigns, because they address real needs and they take on challenges which morally the Legion has the high ground. So last year, for example, we succeeded for the first time after nearly 80 years of campaigning. We succeeded in having a military service question included in the national census, which will be of tremendous value to governments and charities and the Legion in knowing where our veterans are, what they need, what sort of shape they're in. Right now, we're campaigning vigorously to have Commonwealth personnel who serve well and long service in the British Armed Forces to be able to apply to settle here without having to pay £2,000 for every man, woman, and child and their family just to make the application form. Again, the moral high road is with us. We're calling on the government to provide this fee waiver before we would step in and pay the fees for them. But at the end of the day, we will step in rather than see service personnel, veterans, or their families left high and dry by government inaction.
You have the difficult task of producing every year the wonderful Festival of Remembrance, which kicks off the Remembrance Day and Armistice Day ceremony across the land. How do you keep that relevant in today's society, with the veteran community gradually dwindling down as we draw down from the Second World War?
Well, like the Legion itself and the way we provide our care for the community, the festival has evolved through the years. Queen Elizabeth was a toddler princess of 18 months when the festival was first performed. And in that year, it was, in the first year, actually, it was like a Requiem Mass performed. The following year, the veterans didn't find that too thrilling, so 10,000 of them crowded into the Albert Hall and had a sing-song of First World War popular tunes. Today, of course, it's absolutely unique combination of a military musical spectacle, high state occasion, solemn remembrance service, and appropriate songs, readings, and memoirs read and performed by some of this country's best loved artists. I actually know of no other nation in the world that does anything remotely similar. It's uniquely British. It's as British as the proms. And it's also incredibly moving. So it's a great honor to sit over it. Another Queen Elizabeth fact, she first attended the festival as a princess in 1945 at the age of, I believe it was 19. She's attended every festival since, barring 2 years, once when she was in hospital giving birth to Prince Charles, another time when she was on a Commonwealth tour overseas. So next year, which is her 70th anniversary on the throne, will actually be her 75th Festival of Remembrance.
What plans have we got for this year's coming centenary Festival of Remembrance, something to give the listeners something to look forward to?
I think we talk about not so much 100 years of the British Legion, it's also 100 years of remembrance. Remembrance as we know it came together in 1921 under the Legion. It was the first year we had the cenotaph ceremony, the poppy being worn, the grave of the unknown warrior in place, the 2 minute silence, all of those things which are now knitted into the national fabric first came about in 1921. And of course it's 100 years of the poppy, this enduring national symbol that is so beloved and taken up in such great numbers by the nation. So we'll talk about that, but we'll also talk about how those things have changed. One of the strengths of the Legion is its ability to adapt and to change with circumstance. The poppy is no exception, from intricately hand-woven silk poppies in the 1920s to poppy bling and poppies made of the Mahatma Gandhi cloth khadi, poppies that are personalized and placed on products. These things were unheard of even 10 years ago. But remembrance is moving into a more personal space and a less regimented space, and so the poppy will move there with them. So we'll talk about these changes, these evolutions, and I think that will be the backbone of a festival that will, in all likelihood, also pay tribute to the armed forces' substantial contribution to the civilian authorities fighting the COVID epidemic.
My name is Warrant Officer Class 1, Vern Stokes. I'm a Coldstream Guardsman, and I'm also the Garrison Sergeant Major of London District. And over a number of years, I've helped deliver some large-scale key events for the Royal British Legion. In addition to that, on an annual basis, I help choreograph the military support to the Cenotaph Parade and to the Royal British Legion Festival of Remembrance. That close working relationship between the headquarters I work with and the Royal British Legion allows me to see firsthand the impact of what the RBL delivers. Support, welfare, rehabilitation. I see veterans standing tall with serving soldiers. I see pride. The impact is immeasurable. I'd like to take this opportunity on behalf of the British Army to thank the Royal British Legion for what you do and also to congratulate you on reaching your milestone centenary. Well done, and thank you.
And Admiral, if I may ask, you of course are now a volunteer. What do your duties involve on a day-to-day basis?
One of the things that I do is to go to school on Remembrance Day or the first day after that and talk to the little children. And I'm still able to put my uniform on, even though it was made for me 40 years ago. But it's nice to talk to little children and explain to them what their grandfathers or even great-grandfathers did.
I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed to admit that I don't think I could fit into my uniform at all now. But what is your message to the little children that you speak to about war and about your experience of war?
Well, I don't tell them too much about my experience because that would upset them a little bit. Because on my first convoy to Russia, the destroyer that was next to mine, just 1,000 yards away, was torpedoed twice during the night and it sank, and everybody was lost except for 12 people. It was dark, it was snowing, it was rough, and it was just impossible to pick up any more. I wouldn't tell the children stories like that, but I would tell them that things are going on now, like Afghanistan. And it made me think about Afghanistan. As you said, I was born in Rawalpindi. It's now Pakistan, it was India then. And my father was in the Royal Air Force, and he was flying, attacking the people who were the Taliban's predecessors. And here we are 97 years later, and the situation is still the same. But I talked to the children about how important the services are, and hope that some of them will join the services, because I think it's a wonderful way of life. And it keeps you out of trouble, mainly, and teaches you respect for everybody else around you.
82 years on, you must be very proud when you wear a uniform.
Yeah, well, yes. The trouble is, I'm always worried someone's going to steal my cap. Talking about poppies that I'm wearing now, the poppy, which is with the Ark Royal crest, with the poppy in the background. And I wear that a lot, not just on Remembrance Day.
Well, I recall it well, sir. And Robert, you talked about poppy bling. There is a special silk poppy available for this year, as I understand, for special volunteers and so on. Talk us through how the poppy has evolved and poppy bling.
Well, the poppy has adopted, because it was so ubiquitous and associated with something as permanent as remembrance, I think it adopted something of a status where people believed all sorts of mysterious folklore about it, like the red represents the blood of the fields of Flanders, whereas in fact the poppy is red because European poppies are red. Or that the leaf should be positioned at 11 o'clock, or that men wore it on one side and women on another. And this, at some point, may have been a popular pastime, but it was well behind the times when we got into this millennium. And I think that some people were anxious to have the poppy reflect them. What we have learned is that in the post-war periods, both post-wars, the poppy was very much 100% identified with those who'd served. But today, many people wear the poppy as an expression of their connection with that service or those conflicts through family or community or something else. And they wanted that to reflect, as the Admiral does, he wears a poppy that reflects his service. We have poppies now that reflect regiments, services, football clubs, all sorts of different identifications. So people are making a personal expression. We also have poppies made out of the shells of First World War munitions recovered from the fields of the Somme, of which, you know, 100 tons a year are pulled out of those fields to this day. We have poppies made out of Spitfire engines and poppies made out of crystal and diamonds and brooches for women to wear. All of this is a personal expression. My favorite story is how poppy bling really began, which was almost simultaneous calls that I received from the X Factor and Strictly Come Dancing, asking if there could be some latitude in the wearing of the poppy, because for the dancers, the paper poppy kept falling off. And for the performers, they wanted something a bit showier. So we actually encouraged them to come up with sequined poppies, and poppies that were sewn onto the costumes and Strictly rather than the paper poppy. And of course, we said we would absolutely 100% defend their right to do this. But no sooner had these poppies appeared on television than the public wanted them as well. The other great boost that the personal poppy got was when the Duchess of Cambridge kindly agreed to wear a sequined poppy on her dress when she attended a high profile public event, and our poppy shop website crashed for days afterwards with people wanting that poppy. from all corners of the world. So they caught on, is the simplest thing I can say. And we get more and more requests every year of people wanting a poppy, which, while maintaining its reverence for all those who serve and have served in the interests of the crown, they also want it to reflect their background, their identity, and their story. But we've noticed that people more and more want a poppy that maintains its reverence, the universal reverence for those who served and sacrificed in the interests of the crown, while also expressing their personal connection with that story. And we're happy to agree with that and to encourage that, so long as the universality of the poppy is maintained as well.
Hello, I'm Air Commodore Catherine Coton, and I'm head of the Air Staff based in London. On behalf of the Royal Air Force, I want to wish the Royal British Legion a happy 100th birthday, and to say a big thank you to everyone who's worked or volunteered in the organisation over the last 100 years. Your essential work has supported countless servicemen and women, veterans and families during some of their darkest hours. Thank you, and here's to another 100 years.
Julie, you have written this wonderful book, 100 Years of the British Legion, RBL, We Are the Legion. It is comprehensive, to say the least. What, for you, has been the highlight of writing this great book?
Well, to start with, it was an enormous honour to be asked, because I'm the granddaughter of a brigadier and the mother, very proud mother, of a serving officer. And so to be asked to write something about the Royal British Legion was really very special. And Robert Lee approached me in the autumn of 2019, and I accepted. But of course, none of us could have known what was coming in 2020. And so, if you like, it was my pandemic project. And I started writing the book in April 2020, and I had to finish it by August, which I did. And because I couldn't get access to the archives in London, the Legion very kindly sent me out copies of The Journal, which is the monthly magazine that's been going since July 1921. And I had about 30 years of this fabulous resource. And I think the two things struck me very forcibly. One was the energy. I mean, this, as I've mentioned before, this was a young organisation with tremendous, not only clout, but real verve and energy. You know, Field Marshal Haig was right there behind it, giving his all to it. And, you know, quite clear that vast sums of money were going to be needed and needed to be raised. And they never were frightened by the size of the task that faced them. So that was very powerful. But then my personal highlight was when I went on a visit just before lockdown to the Battleback Centre in the Midlands. And I was able to witness the introduction to the course, to a new cohort, 16 students.
Can you just explain what the whole battleback system is?
So the Battleback Centre is fully funded by the Legion. It's run in conjunction with Leeds Beckett University. And the idea is to bring veterans and particularly WIS, wounded, injured, sick personnel together, and to give them a very carefully crafted experience of some lectures, some advice, but a huge amount of physical activity. So the first sport that they start with in the afternoon of their arrival is wheelchair basketball, because that's a great leveller. And it is a very fast and furious game and tremendous to watch. And then they do climbing and they do swimming and kayaking and mountain biking and some shooting, clay pigeon shooting. And the idea is to bring people who are really struggling to cope with whatever their physical or mental injury might be, to a point where they can see that in order to rebuild their lives, just taking tiny steps can help. And that's what the Battleback Centre does. It encourages them to look at their life, to manage whatever problems they have, and then tiny step by tiny step, build back onto the road to recovery. And I read a series of comments in the books that are kept after each course, and I was just so moved by the fact that there were men who said things like, you know, I was ready to walk down a live railway track and Battleback turned me round, or I didn't think I had a future and now I can look forward. And There's no idea that there's an easy solution. It is simply a step on the road to recovery, and it is such a magnificent undertaking. And it's very much the sort of the showcase, the front window, if you like, for the Legion, in the same way as the festival is, and the same way that the remembrance services are. But what it does is it just shows that individuals matter. The Legion is a huge organization. It's enormous and its spread is vast, but it is all about individuals. And I think that is something, again, that I really was incredibly moved by.
Mike, you are an individual that matters to the Royal British Legion. Do you think we overplay remembrance?
Not at all. I think it's so important that we remember, you know, past and present conflicts for those that have paid the ultimate sacrifice. You know, it's part of our history. And I think it's a huge part that we still remember every year for every soldier, serviceman or woman that has paid the ultimate sacrifice.
And Admiral, in 2019, when you went back on D-Day 75, what were your thoughts as you remembered your fallen comrades?
I couldn't really believe that it was happening. And I take my hat off to the British Legion. Not only had I never been on a cruise ship before, but to think of sending, it was hoped there were going to be 300. I think in the end, it was only about 260. And in a way, there was one chap sitting next to me one day, and I said, "What service were you in?" And he said, "I was in the Navy. I was in a minesweeper." So I said, "If you don't mind my asking, how old are you?" And he said, "I'm 104. And he then got up, and he did have a stick, and walked away. But I thought for people like him and me to be together, doing something that we had all been involved in, 75 years before, was a wonderful thing that the British Legion had done. And then, of course, I hadn't been ashore before in 1944. I didn't go ashore at all. And I can remember seeing all the craft going past us when we were 5 miles out. The craft came up all full of poor soldiers, who most of them were feeling seasick because it had been a bit choppy. And I thought, now they're going to a rail fight. Here am I just sitting, not doing very much except firing a gun every now and again. But it was wonderful to go to where the old battlefields were. And my wife was with me, and she took a photograph of me on the beach looking out at Sword Beach, where my ship had been all the time.
Well, it's a great honour to have you here with us, sir. Thank you for being here, and to Mike too.
We are joined now by former Chief of Defence Staff, General the Lord Richards of Hurstmonceux, so, Grand President of the Royal Commonwealth of Services League, who also carries out many official duties on behalf of the Royal British Legion.
As the senior statesman of the armed forces, how do you view, after all your time serving, the Royal British Legion?
Like all of us in the armed forces, I've been aware of and had the comforting feeling of the presence of the Royal British Legion, not just throughout my military career, but throughout my life. And I think that probably is the key to how I view it. I mean, first of all, to reach 100 years, it's quite an amazing achievement. And I often wonder if Field Marshal Haig and the other founding fathers thought for one moment it would last so long. But in a way, this, the Royal British Legion, is his greatest legacy. A long, interesting, was with an organisation called the Royal Commonwealth Ex-Services League that he also started at the same time and the same year with Jan Smuts of South Africa, that focused on Commonwealth veterans. But, you know, both those organisations, here we are 100 years on, that not only look after our veterans materially whenever they might be in need, but I think in a way, if I may, an even more interesting dimension is the sort of reassuring presence and the knowledge that the Royal British Legion is there for us and for them in their hour of need. And I think that's terribly important. And as I say, in some respects, more than whether or not we do require assistance. The knowledge that they're there, a friendly voice, a friendly ear, and if we need it, help. I think that's tremendous. And that's, for me, the most important thing about the Legion. And I just, you know, am in awe of what they do and what they've achieved.
How do you think that original charter that was envisaged under Field Marshal Haig has changed from these very early days, 1921?
Well, I think the essentials probably remain unchanged. That is a hard-headed respect, reverence for ex-soldiers, sailors and airmen that they have served their country, often suffered because of that service. But in its essence, when you distill it all down to the core, I think it's looking after service men and women into the long term, whatever the nature of their service might be.
What is your view on the Legion's representing the serviceman's lot, as it were?
Well, the lobbying role of the Royal British Legion is extremely important. Getting the balance right in their advocacy is a difficult one, because the state government depends on the Royal British Legion. Apart from else, it saves them a lot of money, actually, because through charity, the Legion achieve what otherwise government would probably have to do. So, you know, it's not a one-way street, this relationship. But nevertheless, the Royal British Legion depend on a good relationship with government. Yet at the same time, they must be robust in their advocacy of the armed forces community, and in particular, obviously, of veterans. I think the real test may be how their successors manage it in, say, 10 years' time, if, God willing, we haven't had another Afghanistan or Iraq, and memories aren't quite as sharp.
What is your view about the Armed Forces Covenant and its important place in society today?
Well, in a way, we shouldn't have needed the covenant, but the fact that it was considered necessary is to some degree an indictment of the lack of concern that government and the community in practice was demonstrating towards the armed forces. But look, that's behind us now, and I think it is a good innovation. When so few, relatively, of the civilian part, the vast majority of our population, have any understanding whatsoever of the armed forces and what we do, and you know, numbers are declining further under the latest cuts. I feel that probably the covenant is a very necessary instrument to ensure that government across the piece, not just central government, but local government, the NHS, all the other things that the state provides for us now, does remember the debt that our country as a whole owes the armed forces. The issue will be, though, are they held to account robustly by central government? And I think the jury's out, to be frank. I think in some cases and in some areas, good councils, good NHS providers, they get it right. But we know that, hard times are hard, and other priorities might come along, and they need to be reminded that this should always be a top one.
In 10 days' time, when we stand round our village cenotaphs and our visual memorials, when you put your poppy on and the drummer has sounded the last post, what do you think about it at that moment, and who do you think of?
Fun enough, as I get older, I get more emotional about it. I've always, like you, had an eye for history. And this year I will look back on 100 years of sacrifice of the armed forces, by the armed forces, on behalf of their nation and of their kith and kin, and of the huge numbers that have died or suffered as a result of that service. But then of my own friends, who have died over the last 40 years or so, whether it was in Northern Ireland, Afghanistan, or wherever I had the duty to serve, and also obviously my family. So I think I look at it from a personal perspective, you know, in part, but also with the perspective of 100 years and of someone who had the great privilege of commanding some outstanding people who were prepared to repeat what our forefathers did too. So it's a combination of emotions, but emotion it most certainly is, and a determination, as I felt for a number of years now, to do what I can to ensure that we avoid future wars, because I know that they're usually the result of error and miscalculation on the part of politicians. And I fear we're going into a particularly dangerous era, and we need to be strong, ironically, in order to ensure we don't fight future wars. And I'm worried that that is not really properly understood or being orchestrated.
General of the Lord Richards, the first man to say, thank you very much.
We've talked on this programme of the First World War, the Second World War, and concluded with Michael Lewis from Two Power with Afghanistan. 100 years on, Robert, what are the plans for the Royal British Legion looking forward?
What's remarkable is that the three platforms of the Legion's charitable services, which is remembrance, campaigning, and providing for the welfare of our armed forces community, they've remained constant. But those needs and those campaigns and what we remember have been in a constant state of change. I think two things that have contributed to the Legion's being able to prevail over 100 years of change. One is something that never changes at its core, and that's remembrance, the act of remembering and the poppy. And the other changes constantly at the Legion, which is, where is the need? Are we responding to the need? If we're not, how can we respond? How can we change ourselves as an organization? So we are preparing ourselves now for a challenging century, a challenging decade, where the welfare needs of our community, although the community may be getting gradually smaller, the needs are increasingly complex. And so we are becoming more collaborative and working in a more professional way with other charities to be a conduit, if you will, to ensure that our beneficiaries are met at the point of their need and that those needs are met. And that's an important part of our transition. I think that we will increasingly look to remembrance and campaigning and making sure that they are relevant and modern and up to date and reflect current concerns. In short, we'll do what we've always done. We'll work with others and we'll adapt as fast as we can to make sure that we are fit for purpose in the next century.
To Julie, to Mike, to Robert, and to Admiral John, thank you very much for being my guest on the Oldie Podcast today. Happy birthday, RBL at 100. Some sunny day.
And my thanks once again to all those who contributed to the programme. We Are the Legion by Julie Summers, the story of the Royal British Legion's first 100 years, is available from poppyshop.org.uk, price £18.99. You can support the work of the Royal British Legion by donating online at britishlegion.org.uk or in person over the next 2 weeks to a community collector at stations, markets, shopping malls and town squares throughout the country. Tickets for the Festival of Remembrance on Saturday the 13th of November are available from festivalofremembrance.ctickets.com or on BBC One at 9 p.m. the same day. Remembrance Day commemorations from the Cenotaph can also be watched on BBC One from 10:15 a.m. on Sunday the 14th of November. But wherever you are this Armistice Day on the 11th of November or Remembrance Sunday the 14th of November, please wear a poppy with great pride. So from me, Harry Bucknell, on behalf of Harry Mount, Donna Freed, and all the team at the Oldie, until next time, thank you for listening, and farewell. Oh. The Royal British Legion March was performed by the Band of the Irish Guards, Heart of Oak by the Band of Her Majesty's Royal Marines, Mill and Olive by the Band of the Coalition Guards, the March Past the Royal Air Force by the Central Band of the RAF, and We'll Meet Again, written by Hughie Charles and Ross Parker, was performed by Dame Vera Lynn. I'm indebted to Vice Admiral Sir Ben Key, Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Jackson, Major Neil Hall, Air Chief Marshal Sir Stephen Hillier, Flight Lieutenant Dan Chorley, Charlene Guy, Alex Owen, and Stephen Connolly, who helped in the making of this programme. With studio editing by Michael Siliano, this is a Gamekeeper production for the oldie.